Morris Blamond is our guest, and we're talking about his experiences with Jim Garrison, the famed DA down in New Orleans, who actually brought charges of conspiracy to commit murder against Clay Shaw and others in connection with the JFK assassination. Paris, when we left, we were talking about, where we were on the day itself, November 22nd, 1963. I think all of us that were alive at that time do remember where we were when we heard the news about the assassination. So why don't you go ahead and pick up the story right where you were when we went to the break, when you heard the news, if you don't mind.
And when they first heard about it.
In my life, and I've lived very varied a life, only 2 days do I remember as literally, to use the cliche, as if they were not yesterday, if they were this afternoon. And one was when I was very young, when Roosevelt had died. He'd been president all my life, my young life. And when Jack Kennedy was murdered, I remember pretty clearly the day Bobby was killed, but not as much as I do those other two.
Yeah, same here. I was in California, in San Francisco at the time.
Oh, yes, that must have been very immediate for you.
Yes, it was, and I happened to be coming out of, actually, over in Alameda at a jazz radio station. I had gone up to see about a job. And in San Francisco, Alameda, Alameda, on the little island in the East Bay. This is where the jazz station was. And they were playing jazz music, and I was listening to Al Jazz Bo Collins on another station, KSFO, in San Francisco. And when I went in, he was playing, regular pop music. When I came back down, it happened between the time I left that little jazz station and the time I got to the parking lot in my car, they were playing classical music. And it made an impression on everybody. And, of course, everybody remembers Walter Cronkite breaking up on the air on television.
The only other thing I ever remember that was quite like what we both have experienced was sitting in a cafe in Greenwich Village during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Jack Kennedy was going to come on and announce exactly what the United States was going to do in the face of atomic weapons in Cuba. And I mean, that was the most morbid.
And it was a dynamic event, and most people,
everybody was terrified. What they were. They were afraid we were on the world.
Well, yeah, it looked like it was the end, the beginning of the unthinkable, a nuclear war.
Yeah.
It really did. So your fascination with the JFK assassination, how did that get started?
It was immediate. I mean, I was working on other books at the time, it didn't occur to me to do a book on it, and it didn't several years until I was approached to do one. But the impact was very great, and I admired him considerably, almost as much as I admired his brother. And it was a strange, and I did not admire Lyndon Johnson. So it was a disturbing period for me. But then I went on about my writing and so on and so forth. And it wasn't until about 4 years later that I was approached to do the book.
Now, who proposed that to your publisher?
No, my agent. Okay. He called up and one day, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm working on the manuscript." I was in the middle of a book, and he said, "Well, we have a problem." And I said, "You know what?" And he said, "Can you do 2 books at one time?" And like being giving the response that any writer in his right mind would give, I said, "Of course."
Well, naturally, right.
I'm going to give up the advance and everything, and I say no. And so I said, "But on what subject?" I didn't even know the subject. And he said, "On the assassination." And I said, "But Mark Lane's already done something on that, and a couple of other people." And he said, "No, not on that part of it. You know who Jim Garrison is?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, of course, I've read about him." He said, "You have to go down and talk to him and do his story, do his his investigation of the at the assassination house at the sound, and I said one way or another I'll do both books simultaneously, and I did.
So they gave you enough money to get down to New Orleans and do some investigating on your own.
And
huh?
The advance was fairly good for those days. I mean, for somebody that was, you know, a major celebrity.
You had never met Jim Garrison until you walked in and told him you were going to do a book?
No, first I called Baldwin's office, and I said, I've been asked to do a book. I need only one, to know only one thing. And he said, well, and he started to tell me about the investigation. I said, no, that's not what I have to know. What I have to know is, am I going to get the office's, your complete cooperation in doing it? And he said, absolutely, absolutely. And he certainly gave it to me. And later on, he came up and visited me in New York a couple of times, and, you know, took him to the theater and restaurants and all that sort of thing. So we got to know each other extremely well.
So your opinion of Jim Garrison is a high one?
He was one of the most powerful personalities, and I have met a lot of people, but he is one of the most powerful personalities I ever met. Because you were asking how tall John was. Jim was also almost 6'3", but John was slender as a rail, and Jim was built like a fullback. I mean, he wasn't overweight, but he was, you know, very solidly, powerfully built, and he had great personal charm. Had strange, very large eyes, very large blue eyes. Peculiar. They were slightly protrusive. And
bug-eyed almost.
So when he was in the room, it was hard to, you know, pay attention to anybody else. Of course, he had a big booming voice that went large body. He was somewhat mercurial. He would get onto an idea, and he would really be interested in it. But the minute somebody could say, but Jim, if this is true and this is true and this is true, what you're saying can't be true. And he'd say, yes, that makes sense. The second point I don't know about, and the third point makes sense. Okay, we'll just get rid of that. He'd throw the idea.
So in other words, he was open to all kinds of possibilities, but he shut the door easily as well.
He was completely receptive to ideas, to evidence, to suggestions. He was extraordinarily intelligent.
Yeah.
Well, he was intruding where the government did not want him to intrude. Even going all the way up to the Attorney General, they were doing everything to thwart him. They were set up the newspapers to thwart him. People like Sheridan, who was an ex intelligence agent for the government and was then a newspaper man. They did everything in the world to destroy him. If they thought he was wrong, all they had to do was give him all the assistance they could and let him fall on his own face. But they didn't. They were afraid that he wasn't wrong, and so they tried to stymie him in every possible way.
When you say they were afraid he wasn't wrong, you think a lot of them didn't know one way or the other.
Well, Jim thought that eventually, although he considered in my let's see, was that Till the Heaven, the first book? Anyway, in the set of four, in the first book, I list something like 30 theories that were posited. And, you know, I list all the kooky ones, too, just to be fair. And but when any intelligent person would have eliminated half of them automatically, and anybody who knows the case would have eliminated another six or seven, so you get down to the only people that could have done it are within the group of, say, five. And if you study further, you will realize that a couple of those are improbable in the nth degree. So eventually it is awfully hard not to come to a conclusion of who was primarily involved, not only in that, but with Bobby and King and the rest of them.
So you've narrowed it down in your own mind to two or three groups or people?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're going to get into that here in a little bit. One of those things you mentioned in your book, which I I've done a lot of shows on this subject, but I guess I'm showing my ignorance here. You talk about the old Catholic Church. What do you mean by that?
Oh, by the way, let me mitigate your self-castigation. Very few people, including all those people who pontificate about it, know a great deal about the case. So, you know, if you don't know certain elements in it, it's perfectly understandable unless you've researched it for 20 years. The old Catholic Church is a schism from the RC. It's conceived in its history in a couple of different ways. Some people say that it really broke away about 400 years ago, but other people say, well, it was really finalized in the 1870s when the Pope declared ex cathedra that he was infallible in matters of morals and principles of the Church. Most people don't know. Even the educated people know that that did happen. What they don't know is that the two-thirds of all the cardinals that should have approved that this new regimen in the Church either voted no or walked out. So it was a very dictatorial decision. So the people that had not joined the old Catholics already, a lot of them, especially in the ministry, went over to it. And the old Catholic Church in itself is does not accept the primacy of the purge approach, Pope, I get that word out, and it has basically the same principles. It's not Protestant in any sense. It has priests and bishops. However, it does allow its priests to marry. It is in this country. It has had a rather narrow genealogy. It came down to two bishops, a man named Cafora and a man named Brothers. The brothers ended up living on a mountaintop in Woodstock and reverted eventually to, I guess it was the Greek National Church. And Cafora was mad as a hatter and declared Lake Michigan all holy water, and anybody who bathed in it was converted and whatever. So it's an extremely strange church. Many of its clergy are gay. But of course that is becoming more and more and more evident that so are they in the RC. So you know, it's not so distinguishable from the Roman Church as it used to be thought to be, although never particularly was.
Now, when we talk about the Catholic Church being involved, did you eliminate them? Did you eliminate them, or did you
not the Catholic?
Yeah, right. I understand. I mean, JFK himself was a new Catholic, I guess.
He was a very legitimate Catholic, yeah. The whole family is. I mean, the Kennedys, mm-hmm. Boston Catholics, you know, of whom there is nothing more Catholic. The old Catholic Church claimed among its members, Gordon Novell claimed to have been ordained.
Oh, you brought his name up. I'm going to ask you about him in a little bit in more detail. Go ahead.
Familiar with Bannister?
Yes.
Well, Bannister he had an assistant named Jack Martin, and Jack Martin claimed to be a priest in the old Catholic Church. And there were several other people that claimed to have had the ordination. And in almost every instance, it's specious or...
I mean, I know Gordon Novell. He doesn't seem to be very religious.
Oh, no. Well, he's a devout opportunist.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there's a way to get his name in the paper, he's there.
He was down there during that time, too, I guess. Did you meet him?
Jim once said that I should meet him, and I said, fine. He said, I'll set it up. And a week later, he said he won't talk to you. I wanted to meet him just to interview him for the book, you know.
Yeah.
And Jim said he won't talk to you. And I said, yeah, okay. A lot of people won't. So I never actually.
What do you think Jim really thought of Gordon Novell?
Not much. He thought he was an opportunist. I mean, it was very hard to know anything about him and not think he was an opportunist. One had to decide for oneself whether was he connected with the company or wasn't he. Was he ever down in Mexico or wasn't he? How well did he know Oswald? Or did he really ever know him?
And you never really got a chance to visit with Gordon about that.
No,
But did you draw the conclusion that Novell knew Oswald?
I think it was very likely that he met him. There's a big difference between knowing and meeting. But I don't think it's relevant.
Sure.
I don't think that Novell had. Was that anywhere involved in the crime? And certainly, I don't think that.
Have you heard about the umbrella man story about Novell waving the umbrella during the shootings? You know those films.
Oh, you mean being the umbrella? No, he definitely was not the umbrella man.
Okay.
No question about that. That's another attempt to be somebody. You know that people will pay attention to.
Yeah. Now. I think maybe even Gordon confessed to me one time that he was standing in the way of the Garrison investigation, insinuating he was part of the company, whether he was or not, I don't know.
Well, there are those who believe that he was paid to disrupt Garrison's investigation as much as possible, and I don't know that anything he ever did disrupted it terribly. But he certainly was not cooperative. Let me
ask you this much: Was Garrison surprised that his case fell apart like it did?
No, he thought that the trial would demonstrate that Shaw had been involved. The many members of the jury, by the way, interviewed afterwards, said that they thought that there was a great likelihood that he was, but there was simply not enough evidence to bring in beyond a shadow of a doubt. After it was not a popularity contest, it was a trial, and if they couldn't convince themselves that he was guilty of, remember, he wasn't accused of doing the crime. He was convinced of being a conspirator in the construction of the crime. And they simply didn't believe they could accept that beyond a shadow.
Now, you got along with Jim Garrison rather well, and he became a friend. His conclusions and your conclusions about the JFK murders, do they coincide?
No. Jim was loath to think that it had anything to do with our own government. He went through several phases, which any district attorney does. You know, as the evidence comes in, first it looks like one person, then it looks like somebody else, and then he discards the third, etc. He was very inclined towards the Cuban theory at one point. But then evidence came out that Kennedy had been in contact with Castro, writing back and forth and trying to establish a détente, and it was evident to him that if that was the case, then certainly Castro wasn't going to be responsible for any harm coming to Kennedy, because he knew perfectly well that he would be succeeded by Johnson and he would never make a deal with Johnson. So Jim had to discard that possibility. He considered the Russian possibility, thought it was unlikely because he could never see anything that the Russians would have to gain, and I agree with him on that point. Probably his main target towards the end was the syndicate and or the company, and I think he ultimately probably believed that it was a combination of both a renegade element of the company and probably a practical element of the mafia.
Well, you know, if you're a district attorney in New Orleans, you have lots of experience dealing with mafia cases.
Well, he of course knew Marcello, and he didn't personally know Trafficante, but he did know Marcello because Marcello was sitting right there in New Orleans for a quarter of a century. Probably the most curious, and all the years I knew Jim, and all the research I did with and for him, the one thing that I will give you some material for hypothesis that I never could quite get my mind around was Jim never accepted if you stated something about Marcello and the mafia, he would say, "Oh, don't believe everything you hear," or "I have no reason to believe that he's really involved," or etc. In other words, he disavowed any conviction that Marcello, who was unquestionably the godfather in that part of the country, was in point of fact just that. And leaves one wondering, but I've never come up with an answer for that.
Was he in the mafia's pocket? I don't think so, Jim Garrison. He seems like he was a pretty independent character down there.
He was tremendously independent. Matter of fact, he got elected originally without the support of the Republican or the Democratic Party. He ran as an independent. He was reelected again, and then he was reelected again. He was the most popular district attorney the New Orleans ever had, and one of the most popular in the country. If he had kept his hands off of the Kennedy assassination, the probability that he would have been senator or governor is about 5-1 in his favor. But he just simply demolished his career by beginning this investigation.
Now, in his latter years, did you have an occasion to talk to him or be around him?
No, after the case was over, and we were in touch up to the time of the House Committee on Assassinations, somewhat from time to time, but our relationship was almost completely based upon on the case. We did not have familial contacts, or our reading habits were not the same, etc. Once the case was over, as far as it ever being solved is concerned, we just had very little left to talk about, and our relationship sort of dwindled. We occasionally spoke over a period of about 7-8 years, that was an awful long time ago, over 40 years ago, so we finally just drifted apart. And then, of course, he became quite ill, and he was bedridden for the last year of his life.
He doesn't strike me as a man that would take defeat very easily, probably the reason he was a good district attorney to begin with.
Oh, he fought as long as he could, but once he brought someone to trial, and he was utterly thwarted. He was not permitted to bring in certain witnesses. He was not permitted to introduce certain testimony. As a matter of fact,
do you think the judge was working with the government preventing this, or what?
Well, I can't make an evaluation of that. Everybody else was. I don't see why. If you're in a public position, one thing you don't want to do if you care about your career is you don't want to make the people above you mad.
Why do these people, you know, the huge group, we still have it all the time, why do they not want the truth out?
Well, remember that we really still don't know all the facts about Lincoln's assassination. We don't know really all of the facts about the Kennedy assassination. The country knowing that there was an attempt in 1933 to overthrow the government, take Roosevelt prisoner, and declare martial law.
Now, who was behind that?
Allegedly, Al Smith may have been involved, but the man that they wanted to lead it, and his name is just at my mind just for the moment, was a major military figure, and I have never heard of anyone winning the Medal of Honor twice. He had won it twice. He must have been.
When we talk about the Kennedy assassination, the murderer of a president, you know, all kinds of people come to mind. In my estimation, the military-industrial complex, the CIA, the mafia, were they working together? Down in Dallas, it was a big right-wing group, H.L. Hunt. Even the police chief was a right-winger.
You know, in the Bobby case, now it's people who do the kind of work that I do have long suspected that the company was involved. But that the Los Angeles Police Department was involved, and now it's come out that three of the now conveniently dead CIA men were in the kitchen at the time. Mm-hmm. Now it is established almost beyond any doubt that
there were extra bullets the police never counted.
That there were between 10 and 13 bullets, and his gun held 8. He was in the wrong position. Bobby had bullet holes in his back, and Ciaran was about 4 feet in front of him. At the closest that he ever got was 3 or 4 feet in front of him. I mean, just, you know, there is an element that rules this country that has nothing to do with anybody that gets elected.
With the same people that killed Bobby Kennedy, the same ones that killed his brother John? Maybe not the same people.
Oh yeah, and King, it's quite possible that Malcolm may have been included in the group too. Possible that Rockwell was included in the group. People who make waves, people who disturb the equilibrium. You know, you can get away with a great deal, and so long as you're not really disturbing anything that vital, nobody's going to bother you. But you begin to really shake things up, and it's amazing how many people go. Yeah, I mean, you can go to other people like Forrest Stahl.
Yeah, he conveniently committed suicide, but there was ever evidence that he didn't want to go out that window.
Paul, guy was killed in the plane crash.
The senator from Minnesota.
Yes, exactly.
I've always said if you're a liberal Democrat, you don't want to fly in a private plane.
It's amazing. You can just keep on going on and on and on and on, you know.
So who are these people, the groups, I mean? Who are we talking about?
Well, now you're getting into very rarefied stuff, but it is the cartel, the melding of the people who are most often responsible for getting a president elected, a major senator to being elected, is the kind of group that is of which David Rockefeller is more powerful than the president. He has been more powerful than the president for decades. Is the people who are involved in the Bilderberg group, the people who are involved in the Council on Foreign.
Why would Rockefeller, for instance, want to knock off JFK?
Well, he's the one who created the Trilateral Commission.
And so you think it all goes back to.
Oh, well, the Trilateral Commission and the
Bilderberg group?
They're all interlocked, especially with the Bilderberg group, and they are, of course, interlocked with all of the powers that be in Europe. And Japan, and not in China, because of course we can't do anything to them, but other major countries, parts of the world that just don't figure at all, most of Africa and most of South America, but that if they were needed, they would be brought into the fold.
Well, now, was the Kennedy brothers eliminated, and Martin Luther King eliminated because they just didn't like what they were saying, or were they getting in people's pockets, or what? I mean, in other words,
he said at one point regarding the CIA, direct quote, "I will smash it to smithereens."
And it's pretty well known that he left them hanging there on the Bay of Pigs.
Yes. Well, he didn't really leave them. He just didn't come in and save them because that wasn't his operation. It was theirs.
Right.
People think the president has this ultimate power, but the president's power is very limited except when he breaks the law, like Bush. Who has broken something, I don't know, I saw a list of it the other day, something like 212 laws and statutes since he came into office. But,
how come no one's tried to prosecute him yet?
Well, that's a good question, and
I don't have an answer for that either.
It's just that we have never had a public that is so indolent, so preoccupied with itself, that it's simply the old thing. If you give me what I want, I won't care if you take everything else. And people that in this country live better than anywhere else in the world. This country has about 80% of all the wealth of the world.
Yeah,
I mean, 3.5% of the population.
One of the things I've marveled about the neoconservative movement and Bush in particular is the fact that evidently, if you spread the wealth around a lot, you can get away with a lot. Doesn't have to be a lot of money to each one, but if they're all making it.
The elections are won.
We've only got about a minute or two left. I want to give a big plug for your book and all of that later.
There's a film made probably before you were going to films much called The Great McGinty, and the beginning of this career of the guy who becomes very powerful is he comes in and he has this bunch of papers in his hand, and they indicate how many times he's voted, and the guy says, "How many times did you vote?" And he said, 22. Dollar for every one of you. But that, it's a marvelous center.
It's amazing what's happened to our vote as far as voting machines and all of that too. We could go on for hours here. You after 3.5 years and 1,600 and some odd pages, you're not going to give me any names, huh?
1,800,
okay.
You're going to have to cut about 8 minutes out of this to make it fit an hour.
Well, we'll get it there.
Well, nice talking with you.
Okay, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.